The topic today is wastewater utilities using sustainable watershed approaches. As a nation, we have built extensive network of infrastructure to provide the public with access to water and sanitation. Much of the drinking water and wastewater infrastructure in the U.S. was built in the 30-year period following World War II, mirroring the increase in our population. Utilities are facing tremendous costs to rehabilitate and replace this infrastructure. EPA has a new initiative to promote sustainable infrastructure and help utilities identify the best practices to address a variety of management challenges. This webcast will provide a brief introduction to EPA's Sustainable Infrastructure Initiative and will highlight the work of two utilities to use sustainable watershed management approaches. So let's meet our speakers. Our first speaker, Andy Crossland, works in EPA's Office of Wastewater Management as the agency's infrastructure, sustainable infrastructure coordinator. In this role, Andy serves as the national lead for EPA's initiative to promote and foster the adoption of sustainable practices and addressing the challenges we face in renewing and maintaining our water infrastructures. Our second speaker, Kevin Schaefer, became executive director at the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District, MMSD, in March 2002. Prior to this, he served as MMSD's director of technical services since October 1998. Since becoming executive director, Mr. Schaefer has worked diligently as MMSD's $1 billion overflow reduction plan. He also coordinated a $58 million long-range planning process that produced the most intensive water quality research ever for six Milwaukee area watersheds. Additionally, under his leadership, MMSD instituted a regional stormwater runoff rule and has been a leader for innovative ways to manage stormwater runoff. Our final speaker, Stephanie Farrell, has been instrumental in applying the watershed management approach to improve stream quality in the area surrounding Knoxville, Tennessee. During her employment as engineering services coordinator, Hallsville Powell Utility District successfully negotiated the first National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, finally known as NPDS, permit in the state of Tennessee to feature a watershed management component. For several years, Ms. Farrell worked diligently to strike a balance between managing engineering operations for the utility and developing the district's water quality initiatives. So now that I've introduced our speakers, let's get started. Andy, take it away.
Hello, everybody. I think we're starting up here on slide three, so we'll probably flip to that for those of you out there. As Ann said, I'm coordinating EPA's efforts on sustainable water infrastructure, and I guess my role here today is to sort of give you an overview of what that really means and all the various pieces of it. So when I say sustainable water infrastructure, I mean water, I mean wastewater, I mean stormwater. And the infrastructure being all the pipes and plants and natural systems that help us deal with our water, wastewater, and stormwater. So where did this initiative come from? Well, as probably many of you know, and as Ann intimated, we're really facing sort of a pending silent crisis, perhaps, or underground crisis, where a lot of our infrastructure is getting quite old and deteriorating, and across the country we have not always kept up with maintenance and replacement of that infrastructure as well as we might have liked. So we sort of have a big bill coming due to replace and maintain that infrastructure through time sustainably, so that we'll have it for in perpetuity. With all this stuff aging, we also have lots of other problems that are sort of heaped on top of that. I mean, the U.S. population is increasing and I think shifting more towards the cities, so that sort of places an additional burden. The investment in research and development through the years has actually really declined quite a bit since, I don't know, the 70s probably was when it was at its peak. Also on top of that, we've been hearing a lot about climate change lately, getting a lot of buzz in the national press. And that also has impacts on our infrastructure and our long-term infrastructure needs, whether it's folks along the coast whose systems are potentially inundated to areas of the country where you're going to see more rainfall or a lot less rainfall, and all the implications that brings for what our infrastructure needs are going to be. Last bullet down there on the bottom of the page talks to the fact that that we do live in an emerging regulatory environment, and issues will continue to come up, and potentially stronger requirements come down the path from EPA. So again, that I think adds on to this already existing problem of all this aging infrastructure. I'm flipping to slide 4, and actually I've somehow messed this up, so you have to hit the thing 3 times, so you have two boxes come up on the screen. So anybody who's flipping through on the computer, make sure you do that. But this slide just speaks to the infrastructure gap. That back in 2002, EPA released a what's been called the gap analysis, sort of looking countrywide, nationally at what are our anticipated needs over the next 20 years. 20 years starting in 2002 or perhaps 2001, actually, but came out in 2002. Anyway, back in that time frame. And this slide just gives you a rough idea of how those numbers came out. And they came out pretty big. The box on the left is sort of our baseline no revenue growth scenario. But if you add up all those numbers for drinking water as well as clean water and both capital and O&M costs, you add up all those numbers and you're somewhere in the vicinity of half a trillion dollars, which is a lot of money. So over on the right, we have this revenue growth scenario just for a basis of comparison, and this is, you can see those numbers are much, much lower, and this is under the assumption that we have 3% growth in the revenue streams over the amount of growth that we have from inflation. So it's like whatever the inflation is plus 3% if we are able to grow our revenues at that rate each year. This is what the numbers come down to, which is a lot more, a lot less scary, I should say. So anyway, this is sort of the scope of the problem. I'm switching to slide 5 here. And is sort of the root of where this initiative comes from. We've sort of broken up the initiative into sort of what have been called the 4 pillars. And, you know, these are, I think, useful constructs for talking about areas in which we can take some actions to achieve efficiencies and try and close this gap. But they all overlap, whether it's better management, reading them down here, better management, full cost pricing, water efficiency, and watershed-based approaches to infrastructure. It's a nice construct for us to talk about some of the things that we and we hope folks can do in order to meet this challenge. But again, I don't want folks to think of this as some sort of rigid divisions here. It's just, to me, a good way to talk about it. So I'm going to flip to slide 6. I'm just going to buzz you through each of the pillars really quickly here, and then end on the watershed approaches one, which is what we're mostly talking about today. So better management. Better management sort of includes a number of different things, whether it's utility management systems. Hopefully a lot of you have heard of asset management programs, which are starting to get a great deal of traction with utilities across the country. So utility management systems such as that, EMSs, environmental management systems, which take a plan, do, check, act approach to utility management so that there's sort of constant improvement against environmental criteria. So systems like that which can really help a utility become more efficiently managed and achieve some efficiencies there, and thereby hopefully be able to address their own personal gaps better. So I wanted to highlight on this slide this utility management collaboration which EPA has been involved with, and this is a group of I guess the folks from 6 of the big national water utility professional associations have all gotten together with EPA and endorsed these 10 attributes of effectively managed utilities, as well as some keys to management success that also come in that same document. So this we think, I mean, this is a real historic thing to have all these different associations come together and sort of agree upon what are the key things here that we need to focus on, and we think that it can be a real springboard in the future for utilities to sort of see where they stand against these attributes and plan to better their operations. If you flip to the next slide, I just included, I figure I was going to list say 10 attributes and keys to management success. I'd at least give you the list of what those are. I'm not going to go through these here, but they're in your slides there in case you want to see them. And the website down at the bottom will give you a link, and you can go read a bunch more about that if you want to. So I'm on slide 8 now. I also wanted to touch on energy use issues with better management, which is also getting a lot of buzz lately. I think it's because of all the stuff we've been hearing about climate change, but also because energy use is really one of the biggest things at utilities, one of their biggest costs for operations and maintenance. And again, with the growing population and shifting populations towards the cities and coasts, that demand is just going to grow. So it's a real opportunity, we think, for folks to look at their energy use and the ways for them to limit that. And it has multiple benefits, both in terms of infrastructure sustainability by adding to the utility's bottom line, but also obviously climate change mitigation and that sort of thing. So I wanted to make sure to touch on that as well. We actually have recently put up a web page that sort of brings together a number of different resources that we have been pulling together on that, and there's going to be actually some workshops with utilities around the country in the next year, and that's sort of in the planning stages, so I don't know where they're all going to be yet, but they should come up on this page if you want to check back there. So let me flip to the next one, slide 9, touch on full cost pricing, next pillar here. And this goes to the fact that in many cases systems are subsidized from a number of different sources. They get the money to run the system from a variety of places, whether it's from federal monies or from local taxes or whatever. And what you really, in order to have infrastructure be sustainable, ideally you need to have a source of revenue that is sustainable, that is not in doubt, that's not dependent on the whims of Congress or whatever local politics might affect that funding source. And so we're trying to encourage folks to look at their pricing structures and try and gear them more and more such that the rate structures are set up to bring in the money that will deliver the service, so that people are actually paying for the full cost of the service that they're receiving. So that's what that's all about. Again, we got the web page down at the bottom for full cost pricing. We got one of these for each of the pillars there. So let me hop to slide 10 and talk about water efficiency, the water efficiency pillar. It's amazing. The U.S. is so ahead of many folks around the world in many things, and yet in water efficiency we're not listed. We wouldn't be listed amongst the top folks. In fact, we use more water per capita in the United States than any other developed country, and you combine that with the fact that there's this government accounting office report that came out and said that 36 states are expected to have some water shortage problems by the year 2013. Well, we're seeing that pretty heavily. This year has been a banner year for shortages. Folks down in Georgia and various places across the country really struggling with this. And so efficiency is one way that we can deal with that, and it also helps reduce the demands on our infrastructure. If we're needing to provide less water through the pipes, we reduce those demands and hopefully reduce our costs and help close that gap. So under the water efficiency pillar are things like reducing water loss through leaky pipes, reuse programs, and WaterSense. And you see the WaterSense logo up on the left corner of the slide. If you flip to the next one, slide 11, give you a little spiel about WaterSense. This is a program that was launched a year ago summer. here in the Office of Water, sort of modeled after the Energy Star program, which has sort of become a household word across the nation and in fact across the world. And we're trying to do something similar to be able to label water efficient products, you know, your water efficient toilets or faucets or shower heads and these sorts of things. And the label is the folks who run the WaterSense program, or make sure I say this right, which is to make sure that it's not just a matter of using less water, but it's a matter of a product that is able to both use yet less water and achieve the same efficiency and effect of its sort of more water intensive counterparts. So you'll see these hopefully more and more in the stores and in Home Depot and that sort of thing, but there's been these numbers are probably actually slightly outdated since I did this a week or two. These numbers are always going up. At least 120 toilets and 30 faucets have earned the WaterSense label and should be able to go into your stores and see that and say, I know that that's going to work as well as something that uses more water. So look for that in your stores. This is a way that EPA is hoping to just get this more into the consciousness of folks around the country, that we use so much water and that there's ways that we can use less. So, I'm going to flip to slide 12 and finally get to watershed approaches to infrastructure. And I always take it all the way out to that long title instead of just saying watershed approaches, because under sustainable infrastructure, we're really talking about that gap and things that we can do on a watershed basis that helps us with that by making decisions for our infrastructure on a watershed basis. And watershed approaches can mean a lot more than that. It's a lot more than just an infrastructure issue, even though that's my job. there are a lot of folks and a lot of other concerns where it really helps us to look at things on a watershed basis. So when I'm talking, I talk about watershed approaches to infrastructure, and I think we're lucky to have a couple utilities on the phone with us today who have some really good examples where what they're doing does impact their long-term infrastructure planning and stuff. So, anyway, the idea here is that utilities and communities and folks need to look beyond the fence lines of their utilities. And when I say fence lines, I mean not just where the plant is, but where all their pipes and stuff goes. And try and make our infrastructure dollars really count. So there's a number of different ways that you can do this, and I've sort of popped up a couple of them here. EPA has been starting actually just this past year, last April, really tried to get a lot of visibility to green infrastructure approaches to wet weather. A lot of folks out there dealing with wet weather problems from overflows from combined sewer systems. And there's a lot of these sorts of green infrastructure approaches. We'll hear about a bunch of them here in a few minutes when I get out of your hair. That can really help mitigate those problems, or at least in a long term way, help reduce the burdens that are placed on the more gray infrastructure solutions. I don't know that green infrastructure approaches are going to be able to entirely solve all our wet weather problems, but they can do an awful lot and help us down as we go down the road. So I'm going to leave that there and leave that to my cohorts here later in the talk to give a bit more about that. I also have up here watershed-based permits and water quality trading programs, which I think our second utility from Knoxville area is going to talk some on, as well as source water protection. So, again, I just wanted to sort of emphasize source water protection end of things, how that can actually have an infrastructure impact if you're able to have cleaner source waters coming into a water treatment plant. Hopefully that reduces the burden there and the costs, and we're able to close the gap a bit. So I'm flipping to the next slide or two here, slide 13. Oh, it looks like I broke out each of these in their own slides. Okay, but this is, I guess, a good thing to point out here with the green infrastructure stuff is that there are many benefits to this besides just the infrastructure stuff, which I focus on. That can be everything from reducing heat island effects to hopefully reducing urban runoff such that the water quality in our streams and rivers improves, as well as if we can get more water going into the ground to recharge some of our aquifers that are depleting across the country. Flip into 14, touching on watershed-based permits. I sort of talked to each of these a little earlier. I'm going to go ahead and flip to slide 15, which is just putting up our two utilities that are speaking here after me, Milwaukee, who's done a whole bunch of great green infrastructure stuff, as well as Hallsville Powell Utility District, who have been working on sort of a watershed basis with their permits and trading programs and stuff. So that gets me to the end of my spiel. Slide 16 has my contact information, so that's in there. Feel free to call me and follow up, or email me to follow up on any of this stuff, or if there's anything I can do to get you in touch with or materials or folks that you need to talk to about this sort of thing. And slide 17 is a mugshot of me sitting in my office, and has the caption questions at the top. So I guess we're ready to turn to any big questions that folks might have.
Thank you, Andy. We will pause now briefly here to take some questions, and we're first going to begin with those questions that are submitted online. And just as a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on the question mark button at the top of the slides page. The first question we have is for Andy is from Tatiana in Gainesville, Florida. And she asks a very interesting question about this issue. How can utilities address the need to address water conservation, i.e. the reduction of water use and waste, with the companion activity of generating revenue, particularly when rates typically are set on the per gallon of water that's used or the per gallon of wastewater that's treated?
Yeah, it's an excellent and fair and relevant question, and something that I think is a real tension point for utilities out there, drinking water utilities. I mean, we want to promote water conservation, and there's really good reasons for us to use less water, and yet we'd like to see folks, being able to recover the cost of the service that they're providing. So I can see where the question comes from. It's a big tension. I don't know that there's any one uniform solution for folks out there. In areas where there's increasing demand, it's probably a little bit less of a conflict in that. I say, for instance, out in Santa Fe, where they're really having trouble looking in the long term, looking at what are they going to do for water supply for the town as it continues to grow. They have no choice but to do water efficiency, and to find a way to pay for that. Hopefully through rates. It's funny. I got my water bill actually in the mail a couple weeks ago, here in the DC area, and with it came a notice that in fact they're going to be charging a flat fee that is just for the service, and on top of that there'll be the fee for how much you use. So there's a sort of a baseline fee that I'll be paying, as well as something that my usage that's tied to my usage. So I don't know, that's one approach that I've seen in the last couple weeks in my bill. So it is a challenge, and I don't know that there's a simple solution for everybody, but hopefully there's a way to, such as the way that is happening with me, that can work out for folks.
Thanks, Andy. Good question. We have another question from Chris in Maryland, and he asks, could you please discuss how some utilities are addressing the likely impacts of climate change to their operations?
Wow, this is really an emerging issue, and I think becoming a very hot topic across the country. And I don't have great examples off the top of my head of utilities that are doing this. I know that New York City has done an extensive an extensive plan. I have not seen the details of it, but I've heard tell of it, looking very carefully what the implications for sea level rise in Manhattan are going to be, because if those of you who've been to New York City, it's not the high country there. We're surrounded by water, and there's some real implications there. But it's a challenge, and as you look at the climate models that are out there, they're generally sort of on a really broad scale. And in order to know how water dynamics are going to change in your area, you really need a model that's going to point to a more local level. So I think it'll take that for us to get more refined in this. But we do have a sense that overall there's likely to be more intense storms. That the number of storms may decrease, but the ones that we get may be more intense. We do know areas of the country that are likely to see greater droughts, and even areas where there's likely to be more water. So if you're planning in the long term for those things, I think you work that into your asset management plans when you're looking at the risk that various assets may be posed for your various assets, and planning for that and their rehab and replacement. So.
Thanks, Andy. Again, another excellent question. At EPA here, we have something called climate-ready estuaries. Perhaps we should develop something called climate-ready utilities. Anyway, just a thought. The concept, though, might apply, that the utilities develop some sort of plan similarly like our estuary programs have developed to address climate issues. And maybe some of the utilities, I imagine, across the country are already doing that. This time, we are going to open the phone lines, and I'm going to take one question. Our time is running a little short here, but if anybody has a question, please identify yourself and let us know if you have a question. Any questions? Okay, hearing none. Hello? Okay, hearing none. We'll move forward.
I have a question.
Okay.
This is Region 3. A question of the usage per capita. I think I've heard numbers from New York City of 200 gallons per day per capita, and other people using 100 gallons per day. How do you reconcile that? This usage is considers newspapers and industry. Shouldn't there be a separation between industry and residential people?
Sure. 200 a day is higher than the numbers that I've typically heard. I've seen them broken down in a number of different ways. You can look at just household use. You can look at per capita use that includes agriculture, which bumps it up considerably. And overall, if I'm remembering right, there's some USGS numbers on all of this. And if I'm remembering it right, the actual household use has sort of slowly been climbing, not going up fast, but slowly been climbing. But the overall use, including agriculture, has sort of leveled out and maybe slightly decreasing for the last 5 or 8 years. So you're absolutely right. You gotta make sure you know what those numbers mean. The one that is stuck in my head is around 100 gallons a day, as something typical for in-home use. I referred to my water bill earlier, and in fact, it said right on there, typical home use, 75 gallons a day. That's what they put on my bill, so I would know how I compared to that. So,
thank you.
Okay, at this time, we'll move to our next session. And, Kevin, I'm going to ask you to unmute yourself and take it away.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kevin Schaefer. I'm sitting in sunny Milwaukee, Wisconsin today, where it's about 15 degrees, so our water issues are a little frozen right now. I would like to thank the EPA for inviting me to present the Milwaukee program and really compliment them on some of the major green infrastructure issues that they took up last year, I believe in August of last year, where they put out some different directives on trying to utilize green infrastructure in a more sustainable fashion by utilities. And there's a lot of buzzwords out there, climate change, sustainability, green infrastructure. The challenge for myself and other utilities is to try to take some of these approaches and build them into a long-term program that really provides the best service for the lowest cost. And as Andy talked about, there's all these cost constraints that are going to be hitting us and fewer dollars. So we really need to find that dedicated revenue source to help address these issues. I'm on slide 18 right now, and I'm going to proceed to slide 19. What I need to do is really talk about some of the gray infrastructure that MMSD has in place and talk about our system so that you understand it and you put it in context with what we're trying to do with the green infrastructure projects. We are a state-chartered regional agency. We provide both wastewater treatment and flood management to 28 communities with 1.1 million people, and we cover an area of about 411 square miles. Slide 20. We have two NACWA Platinum award-winning treatment plants, one at Jones Island, which is downtown, and one at South Shore, which is on the south side. Both of these treatment plants on a normal day will treat about 70 million gallons per day and can go up to 300 MGD each during a wet weather event. So there's a constraint there on flow, but, you know, how do you design a system, how do you plan a system in a cost-effective manner to deal with those one or two big storms a year that might hit it? And that's some of the challenges that we all face. Next slide, slide 21. This map that you see on the right really depicts what the sewage system service area is that MMSD treats. We have both a combined sewer system, which is the light gray area in the center of this map. It's about 5% of the 411 square miles that we treat. And then the rest of it is a separate sewer system. We have a regional system that has about 300 miles of pipe that is fed by 3,000 miles of pipe from community sewers, and then another 3,000 miles of pipe from private laterals. And some of these are estimates of what the pipe lengths are. But it really shows this tree and how the flow comes from the house or the business all the way down to our two treatment plants. So we do have both combined and separate sewers, and it's an integrated system. You also see on this map a dark purple line. This is our existing deep tunnel that was put online in 1993. We are in the process of expanding this tunnel system, and I'll talk about that here in a minute. If we go to slide 22, back in 1975, right after the Clean Water Act passed, our Regional Planning Commission, Sewer PAC, took a snapshot of fecal coliform loadings going to our waterways. And as you note, right after the Clean Water Act passed, we had about 49-50% of our fecal coliform loadings were coming from combined sewer overflows. About 2% were separate sewer overflows, 5% wastewater treatment plants. Industrial discharge was just a little bit above zero. Then urban and rural agricultural and non-agricultural runoff. So it's stormwater. Urban stormwater was 23%. Rural stormwater was 21%. So with the grant program that was in place and some of the financial incentives that came in after the Clean Water Act passed, the district embarked on a huge gray infrastructure effort to improve our system. And looking at this pie chart, we targeted the largest pieces, the CSOs, the SSOs, and the wastewater treatment plants. Next slide, slide 23. As I said earlier, we built a deep tunnel system that was completed in 1993. The first full year of operation was in 1994. And at that time, it had 405 million gallons of storage. It's 300 feet below ground, 19.4 miles long. Diameter ranged from 17 to 32 feet, and it was designed to minimize basement backups and combined sewer overflows to about 1 to 2 a year. Now, as you see, in 2006, we added on to the tunnel. We added another 89 million gallons of storage, bringing us up to 494, and we're up to 26.5 miles long. We currently have an active construction project which will add another 27 million gallons of storage to the system. Next slide. So this shows what all that work that came out of the Clean Water Act from the, and then work in the 1980s and 1990s did for us. Prior to the deep tunnel coming online, we averaged between 50 and 60 combined sewer overflows per year. We also averaged between 8 and 9 billion gallons of overflow per year. The tunnel came online, as you see, the first full year of 1994, an immediate reduction in volume, and right now we're averaging just under 1 billion gallons. So we went from 8 to 9 billion down to 1. And we went from 50 to 60 combined sewer overflows down to an average right now of 2.2. We've had some very good years, 2003, 2006, where we almost caught every combined sewer overflow. But we've had some wet years as well, and that has brought us to the realization that we really need to look at more different ways, more unique ways to try to deal with stormwater and wastewater flows. Next slide, slide 25. One of the things that we're implementing now, which the tunnel expansions are a part of, is a billion-dollar expansion of our system. The original tunnel cost about $3 billion. We're putting another $1 billion into it now by 2010, so this includes treatment plant upgrades, deep tunnel expansion, which I talked about, and sewer rehabilitation, really trying to address the inflow and infiltration that's getting into the system from the satellite systems. Next slide, slide 26. I also said that we have flood management authority, and Lincoln Creek is a great example of some of the work that we've been doing. This is a $119 million project. Started in the mid-1990s, and we completed it in 2002. Before and after, we removed a lot of concrete. We tried to naturalize the waterway, minimize the floodplain without buying out a lot of homes, and really try to bring the habitat back into the region. We tried to take a typical flood management approach, but use a sustainable management approach so that it's not just a concrete line channel, but we're trying to really utilize nature as we move forward in our flood management. Next slide, 27. And with all this work, with all the overflow reduction, we do sit right on Lake Michigan, and we still have beaches that close. And what we started to see in the early 2000s was that we could stop every single overflow from all the wastewater treatment plants upstream of us and ourselves and stop all overflows, and we could even discharge distilled water, if we could, through our treatment plants, and we'd still have beaches that close. So we started scratching our heads and saying, okay, why would the beaches close if there's no overflows and we put out pristine water from the wastewater treatment plants? And we started working with some of the universities in the region to really start analyzing this. Next slide, 28. And what they started showing us was that we needed to do more with stormwater, both in the separate area and the combined sewer area. So we started a series of projects, best management practices, that at the time we just called stormwater BMPs before the term green infrastructure really started becoming so popular. We sell rain barrels on our website. These are pickle barrels that we convert into a storage vessel that you can put at the bottom of a downspout. We are promoting downspout disconnection in the combined sewer area to go into a rain barrel. Rain gardens are another initiative that we have offered half-price plants on rain gardens in the region, really trying to get people to look at the way they landscape their properties and to control the runoff from those properties. Green roofs, that's a picture of the roof right above my head. We have a green roof on our headquarters building. We've probably installed three or four of these throughout the region. They're really something that in communities like Chicago and other large cities, we're seeing this more and more to try to address CSOs and stormwater runoff. But there's so many other benefits to a green roof, as with some of these other initiatives that help with reducing the cost of air conditioning for the green roof. Help reduce some of the heat islands that occur in large municipal areas. So it's just an approach that with green infrastructure, our target is stormwater and reducing overflows, but there's so many other benefits we need to really remember as we move through these. Next slide, slide 29. The Green Seams project is really a program to go out and purchase buffers along our waterways. We started this in 2001. We spent close to $9 million on this. Over 1,300 acres have been purchased. In 2006 alone, we had 454 acres purchased. So we continually are looking at trying to purchase these buffer properties. We put an easement on them, and then we turn them over to a local land trust, or in most cases to the local communities, because they use these for park space and parkland. So it's really a win-win, where we can help control flooding, we can help reduce non-point pollution getting into the waterways. They can utilize this property for parkland and for some of the land trusts to expand their property holdings. So it's been a great success story here in Milwaukee. And also in 2002, we realized that to do a lot of this, we need to make sure that there is a regulation that really helps us control future stormwater so that we're not always chasing our tail. We need to make sure that we can try to get to the point where we control new runoff from either redevelopment or new development. So in 2002, we passed what we call a stormwater rule, and the district has rulemaking authority over our 28 communities. So if we pass a rule, then that has to be implemented through ordinances by the 28 communities, and they've all done that. And this rule basically said that for all new impervious area greater than a half acre of impervious area, they need to control the 100-year runoff release rate to 0.5 CFS per acre of imperviousness and the 2-year to 0.15 CFS per acre of imperviousness. So it really puts some teeth into redevelopment and new development, trying to control that future runoff that would come from that expansion of our impervious areas. Next slide, 31. Here's just a slide showing the Rain Barrel program. Over 7,000 have been sold. They're usually not painted like this. We've had some partnerships with some of the different educational groups and youth groups in the region. They like to paint them. The Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts have been a great partner on this. And it's really a way to teach people how to manage water. This is a barrel. It has to be emptied. It has to be managed by the homeowner. I've got two of them at my house. You really, it allows you to use water in a better fashion. I water a lot of my flowers and garden with this rainwater. Next slide, slide 32. This is another picture of our green roof. This is a green grid system that we installed. It's from a manufacturer in Beloit, Wisconsin. And it allows you to basically have your normal roof, but you put these trays of plants on top of the roof so that if you have an issue with the roof itself, you can remove the trays, take care of whatever problems you have. This has been installed since 2003. This is a great fall picture. It's really quite beautiful, and it's actually grown up a lot more than this now. Slide 33, we also have gone out with some pilot projects. As I said, we called these stormwater best management practices projects, where we actually pay developers, communities, non-governmental groups to build a best management practice. We've got over 23 of these in place since 2003. We budget these as we have money available each year when we do the budget. That's gone anywhere from $100,000 up to $500,000. Actually, I think one year we had $800,000. So it really depends on how the budget works. And this picture that you see here is actually a wetland for the parking lot in our headquarters building here, where we actually converted an open area to a wetland to treat some of the stormwater runoff from the parking lot before it goes into the river system. Next slide, slide 34. Rain gardens have also really blossomed, if you want to call it that, here in the state of Wisconsin. Madison has been utilizing these quite a bit, and in Milwaukee we're trying to foster that growth as well. In Shorewood, one of our suburbs, they've actually taken this and they've partnered with us where they match us in dollars. And they've disconnected some of the downspouts in their combined sewer area. They've built over 50 rain gardens. So it's been a huge, huge success story for us and for that community. Urban Ecology Center is a local education center, and they've helped utilize some of the funding for that we provide for rain gardens. And the benefit of that beyond just building the rain garden is it allows us to educate people that go through this center so that they understand the connection between what runs off their property and polluted stormwater and overflows. We've also installed rain gardens on some of their auto recycling centers and, you know, taken the runoff from a very polluted site and tried to clean that before it goes into the rivers. Next slide, slide 35. I talked about a rain garden program. We've called this the Lake Michigan Rain Gardens Initiative. We've partnered with a local nonprofit that grows the plants, and we provide these to our residents at half cost. So for them, it's a way to get native species, deep-rooted plants that they can build a rain garden with at a reduced cost. And at the day, on the day when they come and pick these up, we have a program where we tell them how to build a rain garden. We show them how to lay out the plants, and it's really a great community effort. Next slide, 36. Cisterns. This picture is actually not from Walnut Way, but we have a neighborhood in a low-income area of Milwaukee that has just been a tremendous partner on working for stormwater controls and installing four residential cisterns on homes. They also have urban gardens in empty lots that are adjacent to these homes. So they use the water from these cisterns to water the urban gardens, and then they take the vegetables and plants that they grow there and distribute it through the neighborhood. So, again, great educational piece for that neighborhood. Takes the water off our system, uses the water to benefit this low-income region. And it's just one of those things where you drive through the community and you're so proud to just be part of an effort like that. Next slide, 37. We also had a historic pump station that was built in the 1890 time frame. We called it the Milwaukee River Flushing Station. Basically, this was our first wastewater treatment plant in Milwaukee. We pumped water in the 1890s out of Lake Michigan over a ridge, and we flushed the Milwaukee River out into the lake because it was filling up with polluted sewage. In the 2002 time frame, we converted this pump station over to a stormwater management education facility. We actually partnered with a local coffee roaster, and it's now half coffee house and half education center. And if you go to the next slide, slide 38, the Altera Coffee is the company that has partnered with us on this public-private partnership. Now, in the picture to the right, you'll see a darker pavement versus the lighter gray pavement. The darker pavement is actually porous asphalt. You can pour a gallon of water on this, and it soaks right in. It's just amazing. Downspout disconnection, rain barrels, rain gardens. We installed a water quality inlet filter for the rest of the runoff from this parking lot. So it's another great way to connect public education, public outreach with great ways to manage stormwater. And we estimate about 30% reduction in runoff from the site. Here's a larger park that we had to rebuild for one of our flood management projects, and we put in bioretention. As you can see in the lower right, we're squirting water onto this parking lot, which is porous asphalt. We have porous concrete in this as well, curb cuts to take the water. So it's just another very good way to manage stormwater and hopefully get people to understand that they can do this on their own property. Here's some of the numbers, slide 40, from the volume reductions that we've seen. If you did just a downspout disconnection, we're seeing about a 12% reduction. If you combine that with a rain barrel, it would go to 14%. Combined with rain garden, 36%. And you can see the numbers as they go up. Bioretention and green parking lot, which is really a combination of porous pavement and bioretention. These numbers show that there's a significant benefit that can be realized through some of these practices, and these are very sustainable practices. Next slide, 41. This shows some of the reductions in pollutant levels that we're seeing. All of this data is continually being added to. When we started some of this work, we realized that there was not a whole lot of good scientific engineering information on how to handle these, or what the benefits of these practices were. And so we've been working with others to try to do that. Next slide, 42. Just last year, working with the Regional Planning Commission, we took a very holistic approach. What we wanted to do is to blend the gray infrastructure with the green infrastructure and show that this was a way to improve water quality and to really see how we could do that. So this is really the roadmap to working into the future, and we used the EPA's watershed approach to do that. So the red box that you see on the map shows our service area, but we really worked with the planning agency to model a significant area upstream and downstream of our service area and looked at nature's boundaries, the watersheds themselves. We modeled over 1,127 square miles of area for every type of land use, urban, agricultural, porous, impervious, really looking at what the quality of water was and the quantity of water that came from these various land uses in 9 counties and 83 municipalities. It took about 6 years to do this work. As I said, we just completed it last year. It was a monumental effort by my staff and by a lot of people at the Department of Natural Resources and at the Regional Planning Commission. But it really has told us where we need to focus in the future. And some of these graphs come from last August. They have been updated a bit, but the numbers are basically the same. On the Milwaukee River watershed, using this watershed approach, what we found for, say, total phosphorus is wastewater treatment plants were about 19% of the source, industrial 30%, 34%, non-point rural 34%, urban. Non-point urban, 12%. If you look at fecal coliforms from the bottom, it basically shows that CSOs and SSOs have gone to about 3-4% of the total load, and it's really switched over to a stormwater runoff issue here in the Milwaukee River Basin. The next slide is 45. This shows the transformation from 1975, that pie graph that I showed you before, to where we are right now, and we use the baseline of 2000. We put $3 billion into CSOs, SSOs, and wastewater treatment plants, and we were able to reduce the size of the pie by about 25%. And we also reduced the contribution of CSOs, SSOs, and wastewater treatment plants to be about 11% of the load, where before, you know, you were in the 56% range. So now what this graph tells us is the green infrastructure, the stormwater management, the ways to address urban and rural stormwater runoff. That's 89% of the problem, the loading, and we need to really try to focus on those constituents as we move forward. And as I said on this last pie chart, I think this latest pie for 2000 has been updated, where 55% is more like 65% for urban, and the rural piece is a little bit less, but it's still about 11% point and 89% non-point. Next slide. So taking that information, we started looking at where we want to proceed in the future. We started working in more earnest with our local universities. University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee has a Great Lakes Water Institute. They were doing DNA typing for us of pollutants. They did some bait and transport to tell us once the pollution got in the water, the bacteria, I should say, how did they survive through the waterways. We did some human source studies of stormwater and some endocrine disruptor investigations as well, trying to bring the science out so that people could understand that what the modeling was showing us was connected to, stormwater. Next slide, 47. We're in the process of expanding our water quality monitoring program. We're putting in some in-stream continuous ambient monitoring stations. Next slide, 48. We're trying to build off existing frameworks. We're working with the local municipalities to try to develop a collaborative effort, and this also includes the NGOs in the region. and we're calling this right now the Milwaukee Regional Partnership Initiative. Take that pie graph and say, where's pollution coming from? How do we spend the next dollar in the most beneficial way to address that pollution? And how, as a region or a partnership, through this partnership, are we going to address that? There's currently 8 municipalities on the Menominee River watershed that we've talked to about really using a expanded municipal monitoring program so that their individual permits could eventually be really morphed into maybe a watershed permit. And that's one of those future goals that we're working towards, and we're providing some of the monitoring for those communities to do that. Next slide, 49. We've also kicked around the idea of total maximum daily loads, and this presentation that I'm showing was one that I gave last August to a SWPCA conference. And since last August, we've been talking to our Department of Natural Resources and others, and we're right now, we're probably going to step back a little bit from a third-party TMDL, which is what we had been thinking of doing, and really take the next step, which is to develop a watershed action plan and develop these plans that identify, they still identify loads, they still identify actions that need to be taken to address those loads, but it's not quite that TMDL point, just so that we can allow some of the discussion to catch up with the science and the modeling. We're also hoping to pilot a watershed permit by using this, what will now be a watershed action plan as the basis for everything, and then use some of the existing programs, the green infrastructure, green seams, and some of these other adaptive approaches that we move forward with. And then hopefully, and I'm hoping we can get to this, get to a water quality trading program on slide 51. To really bring a market-based approach, because what we're going to have to do at first is really concentrate on the urban stormwater piece, but we need to make a market model that makes sense for the agricultural community to come into this discussion. And so hopefully a market-based approach through water quality trading will help us to make that that leap. Next slide, 52. This really is a generic depiction of the partnership initiative itself, trying to bring government, non-government, business, and educators all together by watershed, so have it structured by watershed into this community council so that issues that may be important to the Kinnickinnick River and aren't important to the Menominee River, we can focus our resources, prioritize the projects, and make them pertinent to the neighborhood level to address these different approaches. Most importantly, working along what is now the action plans, tip to the permit, the water quality trading will provide the path. And what we're really looking to do is go beyond current regulatory requirements because we've really addressed the CSO issue, the SSO issue. We still have 303D listed waterways. And we need to try to find ways to go beyond what's required, still improve the waterways, but do it in a manner that's maybe less costly than some of the other approaches that we've looked at. And it gets back to leadership. This is what I started with. EPA took some huge steps last August with the Statement of Intent on Green Infrastructure, the Water Quality Trading Toolkit on August 7th, NPDES permits and enforcement, use of green infrastructure in those on August 16th, and then the guidance on the watershed permitting on the 23rd. These are the tools that we needed. We need to take the next step and really start implementing these in some of our permits themselves. And there's in slide 55 an ugly picture of me, so I will take any questions.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. We will briefly pause now here to take some questions, and we're going to first take those that are submitted online. Again, as a reminder, you may submit questions online at any time by clicking on the question mark button at the top of the slides page. Kevin, the first question that we have is from Paula in Washington, D.C., and she asks, how do you enforce your stormwater rule?
Am I still muted?
No, you're good.
No? Okay, thank you. Our stormwater rule, the 28 different communities that are part of our sewage district are required in the rules to adopt ordinances that are compliant with the rule. So it's built into the backbone of the district, that these rules must be implemented. There's a variety of steps that we could take if we had to. We've never had to do that, but the rules themselves are enforceable. And the communities have been absolutely great partners on helping us develop these rules. The stormwater rule itself took about 2 years of just discussion through all the technical folks at our municipalities to make sure that we addressed all the issues and we had something that would really improve water quality. So my hat's off to my communities. They stepped forward. They did the right thing. They knew this was the right thing, and it's been a real success story for us. But it is enforceable through our through those local ordinances.
Thanks, Evan. We have another question from Diana in Spokane, Washington, and she says, it seems that water reuse is an important approach to sustainability, yet there are significant permitting issues to address. And she poses the question, how can we bring industry and regulatory agencies to a closer partnership with respect to agriculture and urban reuse opportunities? So this question of water use, reuse, how can we get that to happen?
I don't know if it applies just to water reuse, but what we've done here in Milwaukee is we've really tried to rely on the scientific community. We've gone back to the universities. We've done some of the DNA studies that I talked about, really trying to get the science to say this is the right thing or this is the source of this pollution. Where do we need to go next? On water reuse, for us, we're right on the Great Lakes. We don't have a water supply problem like some areas of the country do. But water conservation, water saving devices are still very important here. I think our per capita usage is only about 58 or 60 gallons per capita per day. So we have a lower number than some of those that you heard earlier. So water reuse is still important. On industry in the Milwaukee area, we've seen a reduction in flows from some of our wet industries. But it's really been the economics of water that have brought them to that. And it's been better for those industries to reduce their water usage by reusing it or more efficient using that water, but it's been more of an economic driver for them.
Okay, thanks, Kevin. We have another question from Talil in Los Angeles, California, and he asks, or she, I'm not sure, any data on costs of the BMPs versus the cost to treat?
That's what we're hoping to get to. We don't have a good comparison on dollar per gallon treated versus some of these various different approaches. When we started the BMP program, we really took a shotgun approach and we just, you know, went out and whoever would apply and we found that there was good existing data that we could then do a before and after comparison on. We selected those projects and built them. So what we're doing now is gathering the data, trying to determine some of the costs on the BMP side, because we can compare that eventually with the cost to treat, but we got to get to that point. And I need to stress, you know, green infrastructure is not the total solution. It needs to have a strong backbone from gray infrastructure, which in Milwaukee we're fortunate to have. Green infrastructure will help immensely, but you really need to guide your program so it's a mixture of both.
Okay, thanks, Kevin. Although the question is not exactly germane to what I'm going to say here, we just put out a document on costs related to reducing stormwater costs through using low-impact development strategies and practices, and I guess it does get to this issue of cost. This report that we issued in December 2007 looked at 17 case studies from across the country and found that in general, in most cases, it was less costly to use so-called low-impact development practices as opposed to traditional stormwater practices. In fact, the capital cost savings ranged from 15 to 80%. So this is one aspect of the, it's not really, we're not able to compare the costs of low-impact development to treatment, but we are finding that using LID practices are generally cost-effective. So I urge you to take a look at this report at our website at www.epa.gov/OWL, spelled O-W-O-W, /NPS/LID, LID for low impact development. If that's too many words there, just go look at our non-point source page and you'll find it at the top of the page. I have one more follow-up question that's sort of a spin-off, Kevin, that we received from Mark from Urbana, Illinois. And he asks, do you have any data on how well the various BMPs have reduced microbial pathogen runoff, particularly non-bacterial pathogens such as protozoa and viruses?
In Urbana, Illinois, I grew up in Rantoul, so that's my old stomping grounds. I don't think we have anything on microbial or bacteria reductions from some of these approaches. I think that's the next step to really get into getting a clear picture of where these approaches might benefit the region. So I guess the answer to the question is no, we don't, but it's something that we need to move towards.
Okay, thank you. Another question, Kathy from Albany, New York asks, Kevin, what funding sources are you utilizing for these efforts?
Any and all that we can find. The capital program itself is paid for off of a property tax equalized value that we receive from the residents in the region and businesses, I should say. The operation and maintenance costs of our system are paid for through a user charge billing that we send out to our communities. For the green infrastructure program, the best management practices program, majority of that's coming from that property tax levy, the equalized value for the capital improvements. We have received some small grants from different organizations. Actually, with the Green Seams, the buffer program, we've gotten a substantial amount of funding from Coastal Zone Management Grants and through the state, and they've been a big partner on this. But a lot of it's just out of our capital improvement program.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. At this time, I'm going to ask if anyone would like to ask a question over the phone, so please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before you ask the question.
My name's Charmaine Berry. I'm at Region 9.
Okay, go ahead.
My question was, I was surprised at the high percentage of fecal coliform that came from urban stormwater runoff, and I was wondering if you had a sense of what the source of that was. If it was urban wildlife or pets, or how much was from leaking sewer pipes, or what?
Yeah, and that's a great question. That's one of the ones that a lot of that we internally asked ourselves. When we started seeing the results from this watershed approach, we started seeing this high urban fecal coliform load. And that prompted us to go back to the Great Lakes Water Institute. And on one of my slides, I talked about human typing of stormwater. We went back and we took samples of flow coming through storm sewers during dry periods and wet periods. And we started finding human indicators in that stormwater. And this is in the separate sewer area. So we've worked with those communities, and we're still going through that process. We've only done just a small sampling. But Milwaukee is an older community. There's pipes that have aged and cracked and are now, probably interconnected through some of the groundwater flows. So we've gone through and said, okay, that seems like a high percentage. How much of it is actually illegal connections or broken pipes from sanitary sewer getting into storm sewers? And we've also done some DNA typing at the beaches. And at the beaches, we're on the lakefront, so we have a heavy seagull population. And UWM Great Lakes, again, back in 2000-2001 timeframe, found that about 80 to 85% of the fecal coliforms that were closing the beaches were coming from the birds, from seagulls. So depending on what area in the watershed you're looking at, it's a mix of sanitary flow getting into storm sewers, but it's also a mix of wildlife.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. I'm going to ask if there are any more questions from the phone lines. One more question, possibly. Okay, if there are no more questions.
I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
This is Cheryl McGovern with EPA Region 9, and I just recently had to redo my asphalt in my own property, and I was hoping to get some porous asphalt, but going through the bidding process, I was told that water is the enemy, and if I want, something, a durable product that's going to last a long time, that I should go with this asphalt, which I assume is a regular asphalt. So I'm wondering how cost-effective and durable this porous asphalt is that you use compared to the traditional asphalt.
And with porous pavement or porous asphalt, the biggest cost differential between that and normal asphalt is the subbase, because the water is going to infiltrate through the asphalt. It needs to go somewhere, so you need to have a good subbase to take that water. And if you have to, sometimes you might have to have an underdrain in there just to drain it off. So the big cost differential that we've seen is in that base course and not so much the asphalt itself. As far as durability, we've had the flushing station parking lot in for 3 or 4 years through, the freeze-thaw cycle here in Milwaukee. It gets plowed. It's wearing just as well as the regular asphalt. And then the large site that we just installed in Hart Park, that went through last winter fine. And right now we're in the second winter on that pavement. So as far as wear and tear, I don't believe anyone that tells me that it's not as durable as regular. But the cost, it is more costly. It's just in the base course itself.
Okay, thank you, Kevin, and thanks for the good questions. All right, before we move to our next session, I want you to please move to slide number 56. The Watershed Academy's next webcast will be on March 19th. This webcast will cover managing nutrients in your backyard and community. Please visit the Watershed Academy webcast webpage at www.epa.gov/watershedwebcast for more information about this webcast. The information and registration and so forth will be posted probably by the beginning of March. Okay, now please move to slide 57, and we are now ready to move into our final section of the presentation. Stephanie, maybe unmute yourself again, and please take it away.
Good afternoon. My name is Stephanie Farrell, and I'll be representing Hallsville High Utility District this afternoon. I've been working in the Beaver Creek Watershed effort since roughly 2000. I'm very humbled and honored at the opportunity to present the Beaver Creek Initiative to you this afternoon, because it is a true reflection of a team effort. Each team member has brought their very own valuable contributions to the table. As the presentation evolves, I will provide specific examples to demonstrate this fact. Before I begin, I would like to recognize a few key partners. Vivian Doyle and her watershed team in Region 4 in Atlanta have been instrumental in assisting us and always being available for questions or assistance in any manner through the watershed effort that we've been engaging in. And then also the home folks in Knoxville, those that are very instrumental working with the Beaver Creek Task Force, Roy Arthur, the Watershed Coordinator, Melinda Andrews, Chris Grandjou, Tim Gangaware, Ruth Ann Hanneman, and finally, I'd be remiss if I did not mention the utility leadership that I've been serving under for the course of the last 8.5 to 9 years, Marvin Hammond and Darren Cardwell. The two of them together have allowed me the privilege of working with this watershed group for the last 8 years, and I appreciate that opportunity. The title of my presentation this afternoon is Holistic Watershed Management. We'll be discussing integrating a treatment plant upgrade with water quality improvement in Beaver Creek. If you advance your slides to number 58, I'd like to begin with discussing a little bit of the background and describing some of the characteristics of the watershed to you. Beaver Creek is the watershed that will be featured during this session this afternoon. As you can see from the inset, the watershed is located in the eastern portion of Tennessee, slightly north of Knoxville. However, it is entirely within the Knox County boundary. It falls within the Lower Clinch watershed, which is outlined on your map in green. Of the 630 square mile portion of the Lower Clinch watershed, Beaver Creek consumes roughly 86 square miles. The focus of our discussion today will revolve around those 86 square miles of drainage basin, with 44 stream miles that empties into the Clinch River. The basin is long, narrow, and is a valley bound on the north and south side by two significant ridge lines. Moving on to slide number 59. The pie chart on the left depicts the watershed's land use classifications. As you may assume, the land use characteristics are in keeping with a highly urbanizing watershed. Population projections are currently indicating a rapid increase of nearly 45% over the course of the next 25 years, population growth. All these factors combined contribute to the listed impairments outlined on the right, again indicative of a highly urbanizing watershed. The causes of impairment that are listed on the 303D list for siltation, phosphorus, nitrate, E. coli, habitat alteration, and dissolved oxygen. Moving to slide number 60, the next two slides will be reviewing some significant projects within the watershed. I'd like to begin in 1998 when the task force was formed. It consists primarily of agency folks that have been the backbone of the effort. Each agency represented will be outlined in future slides. Also in 1998, Knox County updated FEMA flood study, led primarily by public outcry concerning flooding and resulted in a no-fill floodline expansion in 2000.
Stephanie, I'm going to ask you if you could please speak up, dear.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. In 2002, the initial Beaver Creek watershed assessment was completed. And from this initial assessment, there were 12 focus areas outlined. These established areas are the foundation for the monitoring plan. Our goal is to utilize historical data and establish measurable results. In 2003, the Beaver Creek Watershed Association was formed, and this is where task force members assembled a public meeting, which then formed the Citizen-Based Watershed Association. Currently, the group meets monthly with a faithful attendance of around 30. However, the membership roster and mailing list includes 300 contributors. In 2003, Knox County was able to hire a part-time watershed coordinator, one of the first instrumental tasks that he implemented for the task force was to arrange the committee in such a manner that each committee member could serve in their specific area of interest. So some examples of the subcommittees that were established is a grant writing committee, a technical committee, and an education outreach committee. In 2003, there was an Attention Watershed Education Initiative that began, and this was under the leadership of the Education and Outreach Committee, and we'll be discussing some of those activities in further slides. In 2003, Knox County established a site planning roundtable, and the roundtable was the brainchild of Knox County Stormwater Department, established as a precursor for the new stormwater ordinance. It consisted of a series of meetings established to provide a venue for the development community to speak up about their concerns, and their objective was to produce an agreeable ordinance that both regulators and the development community felt they could adhere to. Moving on to slide number 61, in 2004, assessments for 23 subbasins were completed, and also a green infrastructure plan was commissioned. This green infrastructure plan was a missing component until the task force sought assistance from the University of Tennessee School of Architecture and Design. The local Metropolitan Planning Commission is in the process of developing a new sector plan for the area surrounding Beaver Creek watershed. Through their involvement with the task force, the MPC has learned about the green infrastructure plan and are seeking ways to incorporate the recommendations of the plan within the new sector plan. In 2005, the state of Tennessee awarded the Beaver Creek Watershed Initiative the necessary funds to develop a watershed plan through the 604B planning grant, and also several best management practices were implemented or initiated in that year. In 2005 as well, we updated the GIS land use. Knox County has the benefit of a very established and advanced GIS system. The KGIS's partnership with the task force has given us the ability to generate very accurate data, which has been absolutely instrumental in land use calculations and impervious cover analysis. In 2005, In 2005, EPA Region 4 granted us a consolidated watershed grant, and it was looking at pilot market-based ecological credit trading program, and it was awarded for over $300,000. The goal is aimed at developing the framework for a trading program, and I will elaborate on this concept in the future presentation. CX2M Hill is the firm elected to assist the task force with this project, and some examples of the deliverables include market assessment, market framework, market transactions, and credit development. And in 2006, the most recent watershed plan very specifically outlines our pollution reduction goals. These were identified through the utilization of two watershed models. The first of two models was developed by Jim Hagerman with TVA and primarily analyzes the watershed for nutrient loading. The second model focuses on sediment reduction and was developed by John Schwartz from the University of Tennessee. The data generated by each model has been used to simulate scenarios prior to and following DMP implementation. The most effective practices were then used to generate cost estimates that are outlined in the plan. The generation of the plan has provided the team with the leverage necessary to successfully pursue implementation funding. The task force has recently accomplished this goal with an award from 319 funding for over $900,000. If we move to slide number 62, I'd like to go ahead and just mention each of the partners. Earlier in the presentation, I mentioned that each of them had some significant and very valuable contributions to the team, so I'd like to go through and just name each one individually. The Beaver Creek Watershed Association, if you recall, is the citizen-based group. The CAC AmeriCorps. Hallsdale Pike Utility District, which is who I'm representing today. Knox County. Knoxville, Knox County MPC. NRCS. Knox County Soil Conservation District. KGIS. TVA. Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation. The University of Tennessee. USGS. And West Knox Utility District. So as you can see, we have a very diverse group represented on the task force, including regulators, residents, academia, and utilities. Moving on to slide number 63, well, now we'll be discussing some of the improvements projects, the first of which is the Environmental Stewardship Program, which is a cost share and available to Knox County residents that experience significant quality or quantity stormwater issues. It is available throughout the greater county area. However, several projects have been completed within the Beaver Creek Basin due to the impacts of flooding. Several ag BMP projects looked at livestock exclusion, fencing, as well as alternative watering sources. We've pretty much discussed the watershed planning processes. The two major documents to remember there are the assessment conducted in 2000 and the most recent plan completed in 2006. More specifically targeting our reduction goals. Again, the education outreach initiatives have been very significant under the leadership of Melinda and Ruth Ann under the Education and Outreach Subcommittee. Some of the sample projects include the AAW, or Adopt a Watershed Program, that is really a citizen watch effort. The residents opt to go through a training course, then elect to serve as a watchdog for a designated stream section. Activities include assessments and annual cleanups. And secondly, developing a strong relationship with the local media has proven vital to the outreach effort. Every year on the education plan, there is a line item indicating the target number of articles for publication. Thanks to our local paper, the Hall Shopper, the group has been able to meet and exceed this goal for every year. We've been also developed several construction desk management demonstration sites. Basically, we're working with specific developers and causing them to be aware of some of the practices that they may be performing on their individual sites, contributing to the sediment loading. Expanded our Ag BMP program, and then we have the Eco Trading Credit Grant from EPA, as I mentioned earlier, totaling $353,000. The Senate approved appropriations for $500,000. That was specifically directed to Hallsdale Pike Utility District to implement some of their best management practices. However, it did not make it through the House, so we'll be revisiting that bill in the future. And finally, the 319 grant, most recently awarded for $919,000. Okay, if we'll move forward to slide number 64, I'd like to discuss what is watershed-based permitting. And primarily, it is an approach to NPDES permitting that results in permits that are, A, designed to attain watershed goals with the consideration of all sources and stressors in a watershed or basin, be a component of the watershed planning framework to better integrate monitoring, water quality, standards, TMDL, non-point source controls, and source water protection. So really the beauty is in the very holistic and comprehensive nature of this approach. Moving to slide number 65, we have a brief discussion of total maximum daily load, or TMDL. Clean Water Act Section 303D requires the state to identify waters that will not achieve water quality standards after implementation of technology-based limitations, and TMDLs are required for most impaired waters. TMDL is defined as the amount of pollutant that may be discharged into a water body with the water body still meeting water quality requirements. Moving to slide number 66, we'll discuss the components of a TMDL. We have, on the right-hand side, we'll be going through the bullets, waste load allocations, and they are assigned to each point source discharge. So that will be Halsdale Power Utility District and the other wastewater treatment facility in Beaver Creek Watershed, which is West Knox Utility. Then we have load allocations, which are assigned to the non-point sources. Waste load and load allocations are established so that predicted receiving water concentrations do not exceed water quality criteria, and reserve capacity may be included to account for new or expanded discharges as the factor of safety is needed. So basically, we have a pie chart here that allocates each point source and non-point source in the pie shape. And what we'd be discussing through watershed-based permitting or water quality trading is just playing a little bit with the size of the allocation or the amount of loading allocation per pie size. If we'll move on to slide 67, I've outlined the steps for watershed-based permitting. We select a watershed, identify and engage the stakeholders. Those would be those individuals primarily contributing to the waste load or load allocations. Analyze the watershed data, which would include some monitoring data. Step four would be to develop permit conditions. Step five would be issue that permit, and step six would be measure and report progress. And again, we're looking to always try to accomplish measurable results so that we can show those agencies and regulators that we're accomplishing the goals that we set forth initially. Moving to slide number 68, expected benefits and challenges of this approach. A benefit would be emphasis on environmental results. Promotes watershed monitoring plans, encourages efficiencies and targets resources, and increases stakeholder involvement. So all of those things speak more to local efforts and local influences so that you have a watershed plan that really addresses the targeted issues for your watershed. And then some of the challenges, you notice the stakeholder involvement appears on both. Sometimes it's challenging to get people to come to the table and discuss the issues so that they want to be, encourage them to be involved. That can be a challenge. They involve non-point sources, which are often unquantified and are challenging to quantify, and investment of agency time and resources. So we're charting a little bit into an area of unknown, and that can bring about some challenge. Moving to slide number 69, we discuss water quality trading. These are some general concepts about water quality trading and not necessarily specific to the Beaver Creek efforts. It's an opportunity to meet water quality goals at a lower cost, primarily addressing nutrients, but potentially in the future other pollutants as well. Watershed scale trading creates more environmental benefits and cost savings. And we've seen recent momentum increase in years with EPA guidance coming out and prerequisites highlight best opportunities, multiple sources, significant different pollutant control costs, sufficient modeling and monitoring, and then the EPA handbook, which was issued in December of 2004. So moving on to slide number 70, we'll begin the discussion revolving around the catalyst that led Halsdale Power Utility District to explore a watershed-based approach. A little background about Halsdale Power Utility. It's rather small in the scale of utility. Water and wastewater provider, and we have roughly 26,000 water customers and 20,000 wastewater customers. most of the infrastructure, the utility was established within 50 years ago, and most of the infrastructure is ranging between 30 and 40 years old. So we're looking at some of the things that were mentioned early on in the presentation, ways to accommodate the growth of the area, compounding the effort to replace aging infrastructure, an initiative to reduce SSOs and rehabilitate the existing infrastructure has begun. And the utility leadership felt like they had an obligation to the ratepayers to at least investigate what the best way to go about some of the improvements were and look into the prospect of doing some watershed-based permitting or watershed-based approach to utilities. Moving to slide number 71, we have a wastewater treatment facility that is currently rated for 7 to 8 million gallons a day wastewater treatment capacity. And we are looking at, have begun construction actually for an expansion to this facility. And basically the improvements will be implemented in three phases with the first phase already in completion. The first phase will allow for Halsdale Powell to operate and deal with the high influent flows quickly by restoring the existing lagoons that you can see in the upper left-hand corner to use as flow equalization basins. And they've been online for, it'll be a year, and they've been functioning very properly in assisting the utility in managing wet weather. In phase two, there will be a state-of-the-art membrane reactor, bioreactor, installed and will increase the capacity of the plant to 12 million gallons a day. So the discussion was, as we began to lay out the phases and begin the design of the expansion, is how much will it cost the utility to put a nutrient removal treatment in the process. And the initial estimates from the Jordan Jones and Goulding engineering firm stated that we'd be nearly $10 million to invest in the infrastructure necessary, and that's not including long-term operation and maintenance costs revolving around the nutrient removal process within the treatment train itself. So when we began to negotiate the permit or discuss the permit options with the state of Tennessee, the discussion revolved around the option of looking at doing some non-point source load reductions through best management practices in the watershed and seeing how that evolved and how that improved the water quality prior to us implementing the nutrient in removal process within the treatment plant itself. And the plant still has a design for the nutrient removal, so that's something that can always be installed in the future should we not be able to prove our efforts within the watershed through best management practices. So moving to slide number 72, this slide demonstrates for you, or illustrates for you rather, portions of the stream that would be could be potentially restored with that $10 million that we'd initially discussed installing a nutrient removal in the treatment plant. So the green is the watershed delineation, and the purple highlighted section in the middle represents an approximate portion of the stream bank that could be restored with HPUD funds in lieu of nutrient removal process at the wastewater treatment plant. So please note here that the significant portion of the watershed that could be enhanced, which is slightly less than half of the watershed. And when I'm saying stream restoration, I'm talking about, stabilizing the stream bank and possibly riparian buffers and those types of things. We had some cost estimates for that and estimated that roughly 10 miles could be restored with that money. Moving on to slide number 73, another potential opportunity for the utility district is to involve itself with some land conservation practices. The characteristics of the watershed lend itself nicely to these practices because it is a valley system and there is a significant amount of land that is non-buildable just due to the floodplain. So that would result in, if you took that $10 million, nearly 2,500 acres of available land. And through this mechanism, we would be able to accomplish multiple goals. And we saw those goals being aesthetically enhancing the quality of the watershed in addition to significantly reducing the pollutant loading. So moving on to slide number 74, the next several slides will be discussing some of the best management practices, that we've been looking at isolating to address the specific problems that we've seen in our watershed. The first and probably most prominent problem has been the issue of flooding. Again, getting back to the topography of the land, we kind of lay in a valley system here bound by two ridges, and so we do have significant issues with flooding. Most of these best management practices would assist us in reducing the flooding problem for residents. Slide number 75 is an example of a targeted best management practice. Here we have some poor land use. We've got a landowner that has decided to basically dump spoil soil on very near the stream bank, and it's rather nasty stuff, as you can see from the pictures, and so we'd be looking at trying to restore the buffer in this area and pull his land use practices back from the stream bank. The stream bank is just beyond the tree line there in the pictures. Moving to slide number 76, this we have a typical scene of a yard along the Beaver Creek watershed where we've got a landowner that's mowing right up to the edge of the stream. And we'd like to speak with these landowners about the possibility of restoring the buffer and pulling their land use practices back a little bit so that we could allow for that extra filtration of the stormwater. Slide number 77, this targeted BMP would be addressing cattle exclusion, fencing, and keeping the farm practices or providing some better management practices for our farmers. Okay, moving to slide number 78, some of the benefits of this approach for the utility is we see that the watershed-based approach is poised to solve multiple water quality and quantity issues with less duplication of effort. In addition, the outcome is a sustainable product that also can be viewed as a community asset, such as green space in land conservation practices. And finally, slide number 79. The big news about this project is that the state of Tennessee partnered with Halsdale Powell Utility District and is willing to allow the district to pursue a reduction in nutrient loading in the watershed with no nutrient standards on the end of pipe discharge. So, as I said before, this process will be evolving and will be have pretty beefed up monitoring program to prove measurable results. So in return for this, the Halsdale Powell Utility District has agreed to quantify phosphorus loading in their watershed, produce a watershed plan aimed at offsetting their discharge loading, and not only contribute, but ramp up the monitoring efforts to include a biological component. Okay, that's the end of my presentation, and we'll be taking questions.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. We're going to, with the remaining time, we're going to address some of the questions that have come in to Andy, Kevin, and Stephanie. We've got a couple of questions, Stephanie, for you, and I guess one thing that, and when we first spoke, Stephanie, you mentioned that you're taking a watershed approach to nutrients, and instead of just setting a nutrient limit at the end of the point of discharge, you're addressing nutrients by implementing BMPs. You also mentioned that these BMPs are also reduce a lot of other pollutants, including sediment, temperature, and DO. Is that correct?
That is correct. Some of the things that I did not include that we had discussions with the state of Tennessee about would be looking at the specific downstream impacts to our discharge, to the creek, rather, from our discharge. And some of the things that we discussed there would be some tree canopy to address the temperature loading and also reintroduce oxygen into the stream. So there will be some ancillary benefits to the best management practices that we're looking at employing that would be in addition to just the nutrient removal, just, I guess, more bang for your buck, if you will, like I've indicated in one of the slides. That's one of the beauties of the approach, that we could get more benefits than just strictly nutrient and phosphorus removal. by installing a vegetative filter strip where we can actually filter out some of the pollutants, but we wouldn't be limited just to the nutrients.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. We have another question for you, Stephanie, from Mark in St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And he asks, what type of treatment system is being used and what phosphorus removal treatment options were considered? Was enhanced biological phosphorus removal, where costs are often less than chemical precipitation, considered? And phosphorus concentration limit of one milligram per liter or something else?
Yes, the engineering firm that did the analysis for us looked at both chemical and biological removal of nutrients in the treatment process and costed that all out. The figures that I provided were from them, and I'm sure it could be scrutinized and possibly have evolved over time. However, they did look into all the treatment technologies that are available. And currently, the treatment is oxidation ditch. So we anticipate that the nutrient loading will change from the treatment plant in the future as we move to a membrane bioreactor. So we've requested to work with the state through this phase right now as we're developing the new permit and implementing the new plant so that we can look at what the new loadings will be and establish the future NPDES permit accordingly.
Thank you. We have a question here for Andy Crossland from Amy in Honolulu, Hawaii. Do you know of any, she asked, do you know of any water utilities that incorporate a fee or tax on the water bill to help with protecting watersheds or water sources?
Thanks, Amy. I'm thinking through this, and I don't know that I know any water utilities that do that. I've seen cases where other folks have been doing that. I know in the state of Maryland we have a flush tax that we pay every month, and it's actually a statewide tax that goes towards restoration of the Chesapeake Bay. Also, I know the folks in Denton, Texas have adopted a program where you pay a stormwater fee based on how much impervious surface you have, so that if you have, you know, lots of ways to infiltrate your groundwater, you pay less or something like that. So I know of examples like that, but I don't know specifically of a water utility doing it. I would think they'd maybe put that towards sort of protection or something like that. I know a lot of utilities do look upstream to try and figure out how to have water, cleaner water coming into their water treatment plants, but I don't know of a specific example of a fee on the bill specifically for that.
This is also a question, Kevin or Stephanie, if you want to weigh in.
We will just
go to the next question. Stephanie, we have a question from Lawrence in Madison, Wisconsin. He asks, is the watershed plan that you refer to enforceable through land use restrictions or another regulatory agency, or do you rely just on education and voluntary efforts to reach your goals?
Locally, there has been some discussion concerning establishing a stormwater authority. Currently, there is no regulatory authority that the district nor the Knox County Stormwater Department has with regards to land use. However, we, as I mentioned in one of the slides, we have been working with the Knoxville Metropolitan Planning Commission, who obviously does have authority over land use, and they've been a partner with the task force and are very interested in looking at ways to move towards incorporating the concepts of watershed-based approach in their planning. So that's certainly a significant step that we've been able to make, but currently we do not have any regulatory hammer, I guess, to make that happen. However, we are, trying to counteract that with a significant education program within the watershed and have targeted those people that are practicing land uses that may not be the best for the water quality, and specifically the development community, since in this particular watershed, sediment is such a substantial issue.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. A related question here for you, Stephanie. Is the utility paying for some of the BMPs that are being implemented?
Yes, the utility has been very involved with implementing BMPs, allocating dollars for that, for the BMPs, but then also, you know, it just kind of makes sense because we have some equipment necessary to actually do the practices, and so we've allowed, for example, our construction staff worked very instrumentally to develop a outdoor classroom that we're very proud of under the leadership of Ruth Ann Hanahan and the Halls High School in our district. And so we basically provided the machinery and man hours to build a rain garden, which has become a centerpiece for the efforts for demonstration purposes, and invited the community to come in and view the asset and hopefully encourage rain gardens to pop up all over the watershed. So not only have we allocated dollars, but we've allowed for our staff and our equipment and so forth to be utilized whenever possible.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. We had one of our persons in our audience provided some information about how water utilities are incorporating fees, and Andy's going to share this with us.
Oh, right, yeah, this just in, from Frank in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. He let us know that in New Jersey they are, in fact, doing this. The New Jersey Water Supply Authority has a rate component that they use to fund preservation of critical watershed parcels. And I guess this has been up and running since 2003, and they've done preservation of over 2,500 acres. So there's a good concrete example.
Okay, thank you, Andy. A question here for Kevin Schaefer. This question is regarding rain gardens, cisterns, and rain barrels. And the person from Kelly in Chicago is asking, is West Nile virus control an issue? And if so, how are you addressing this? And he or she is saying, also, thanks for mentioning the green grid.
Oh, sure. The question is the impact of BMPs on viruses. Hello?
Yes.
Oh.
Impact of rain gardens and cisterns, and whether West Nile virus control is an issue and how you're managing that.
Okay. Yeah, we've not had an issue with that. Rain barrels themselves have a screen on the top, just like what you'd have on your screen window. So we're able to control, you know, some of the mosquito issues. On the overflow tube from the rain barrel, you can put an old nylon hose, you know, like what my wife wears, on the end, and that keeps them from going up that hose into the water. For the rain gardens themselves, for West Nile, it's standing water that's an issue, and the rain gardens generally drain quick enough that you don't have that standing water issue. So on rain barrels, we've thought about it. Had a lot of people question us on that at the beginning, but we've really not had an issue because of these other precautions that we've taken.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. We had a question from Talil, also from Los Angeles, and he's asking you, Kevin, if there's a report on the study area available online.
The study area for the green infrastructure?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. There actually is. If you go to MMSD.com, and I can't do it right here, but what I could do is send that to you and a link if you'd like to have that. There's a report on our stormwater program that I could send to you and maybe send it out.
Okay, well, thank you. If hopefully people can find that on the MMSW.com website. MMSD.
Yep.
Thank you.
.com.
.com.
And it's under the report section, so you can look there and see a lot of this information.
Okay, thank you. One last question for Andy Crossland. We have a question from Jan in Kansas City, Kansas. And the question is, are long-term control plans being submitted now with green infrastructure in combination with gray infrastructure consistent with EPA direction and policy and appropriate for submission? So are long-term control plans being part of this package?
Yeah, I think we're right on the cusp of having more of that happen. I haven't talked to the folks over across the hall there as to how many they've seen, but I have heard anecdotally that a few of those are coming in. And last, I think summer sometime, we sort of formed, or maybe it was late spring, formed a sort of work group with our permits folks and the folks in enforcement to try and get model language out for permits, for consent decrees, for long-term control plans on how to incorporate this into the agreements that we come to. So I think we're on the cusp of seeing more than that. There's probably just a couple of them around. But we're definitely moving to try and get that to be more common.
And this is Kevin. If I could chime in, I think that's a critical step. I think more utilities would be able to utilize green infrastructure if they really had the EPA and the state agency saying this is something you have to do as part of a permit or part of a long-term control plan. So I applaud EPA on what they did last year, but we need to take that leap and start seeing them in some of the permits.
Yeah, Kevin, I absolutely agree with you. We're definitely trying to get there. And,
yep.
It's a matter, EPA is sort of at the top of the pyramid there or something, or maybe the bottom. How do I say this? But most of the states are the folks who issue the permits, so we're trying to work with them to get more of this stuff incorporated.
Thank you. Any questions from the audience? We have maybe time for one more question if anybody's got a burning question. Okay. If not, we will move back to move forward to slide 81. I urge you all, if you're participating by phone line, to type in these URLs to find out about our additional resources that are available, links to Milwaukee's information and Halesdale and EPA's information, and to also please provide us feedback on our webcast. If you're on participating by streaming audio, you can just click on the links button at the top of the page and also the feedback button. This concludes today's Watershed Academy webcast, and on behalf of the entire EPA Watershed Academy webcast team, I'd like to thank Andy Crossland, Kevin Schaefer, and Stephanie Farrell for their help with this webcast. And, of course, thanks to every one of you who joined us. This is Ann Weinberg from EPA's Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds signing off. Have a great day.